Welcome back to this final hour of Shattering Mist as we turn the page and begin to deliberate whether or not Paul was a false prophet, a false apostle. One just concluding comment I'd like to make to the in the first hour, both on homosexuality and on racism. As it relates to homosexuality, many of my friends are homosexual. My closest friend and brother in my college fraternity was homosexual. When I was in business, I knowingly hired, because homosexuals typically will have a more effeminate nature, and they will speak, you ask them questions back in the day that you could ask. They ask questions like they speak of boyfriends or girlfriends, depending on whether they were a man or a woman that I was interviewing. I have no issue whatsoever hiring homosexuals. During the time that I owned businesses that were smaller and really was close with my employees, I bring my kids to work, and then some of the most nurturing people were homosexual, and they spend the day with my children. I got no issue against homosexuality. Whatever you want to do is your choice. What I don't like is it being thrown in my face. I don't like it being politicized. I don't like it when the President of the United States says that announcing your sexual preference is a great step forward. That I do not like. And I do not like the homosexual movement, if you will, being so vicious towards those that will even discuss the politicization of this issue. Trying to sequester debates so only their perspective is heard. I think that is a universal problem of the politicized promotion of homosexuality. Now, moving on to racism. My father was a racist. I know what racism is about. Now, my father was a racist in his words, never in his deeds. I grew up really uncomfortable with it. And so I have never myself been a racist. It wasn't one of the things that I had to conquer growing up. But I am particularly uncomfortable with racial labels. I'll talk about racism when we talk about crime. I'll talk about racism when it's in the news, but I don't like the subject because my problem there with it is that I would prefer that we be blind to skin color. I think it really ought not matter. And I'm really uncomfortable when somebody brings up racism or a racist comment because it takes us away from arguing issues. Now, I am routinely called a racist by Muslims who equate Islam with Arab for the purpose of being able to demean those who speak against the religion as being bigots. And, of course, it's a complete misuse of the concept. Not only are most Muslims not Arab, and not only are some Arabs not Muslims, the issue that I will discuss is strictly the religion itself, the doctrine. And there has been a growing movement in the world to make it impossible to discuss racism or homosexuality and to identify those things also with religion, so that if you speak out against a religion, you're lumped in with a homophobic racist. And what we're doing is sequestering honest, informed, rational discussion. And when we take things to the point where a man like Donald Sterling, who I think is a real creep. I mean, there's nothing about the man I like. But he has a history of doing things that are extraordinarily beneficial to minority communities. when a person like this stumbles and is baited and literally entrapped in an illegal telephone conversation and is forced to lose his team over it because you can't, even in your worst moment for the worst reasons, say anything that has racial connotations. We've moved the world into a place where dialogue is being constrained, where an exchange of ideas is no longer acceptable unless you are articulating that which political correctness says you can talk about, and where these subjects bend the ears of people ad nauseum so long as those talking are embracing political correctness and are not opposed to it. So with those thoughts, I do wish to move to Paul. In our program Thursday and Friday, I repeated Yahweh's open condemnation of Paul in Habakkuk. And we spoke specifically of how Paul consistently misquoted God to give the impression that he was somehow inspired by the very deity that he was condemning. And we had moved to Galatians 3:12, which it says, "But the Torah exists not out of faith, but to the contrary, the one having done them will live with them." And it is a grotesque misappropriation of the prophetic verse in Habakkuk that Yahweh used to explain that Paul, the founder of the Christian religion, was the plague of death. Now, the fact is that God has a standard, and Ralph mentioned it in the opening of this program. God has a standard by which we can test whether or not someone is speaking for him or not. And we can apply that test to determine whether or not an individual is doing as they claim, speaking based upon Yahweh's inspiration, or not doing so. And here is the test, one of the two. It begins with Yahweh speaking to the children of Israel and through Moshe to them. "Speak to the children of Israel, to those who engage and endure with God, and say to them, I am Yahweh, your God." With regard to the things which can be considered similar to the practices of the realm of the crucible of Egypt, where you dealt, you should not engage or act upon them, nor any similar pursuits in the land of the Kenai, which beneficially, as a result of the relationship, I am bringing you there. And when you enter, you should not act upon or engage in their decrees or their customs, never walking in or following them. Now, it's interesting that this statement, which is in Kara called out, is specifically telling us that the religious customs of the Egyptians are something that we ought to avoid at all costs. And yet, Paul was literally calling Christians to the religious customs of the Babylonians, of the Egyptians, of the Greeks, of the Romans, whom he told Christians to respect. He said, goes on to say, that with my means to exercise good judgment regarding the resolution of disputes, you should continually engage and actually act with my prescriptions for living, with those inscribed recommendations which cut you into the relationship. You should constantly examine and carefully consider for the purpose of approaching by walking in them. I am Yahweh, your God. Now, this admonition against religion, politics, societal customs, was followed by the statement that Paul sought to usurp to prove his point. And so he says, God says. And so you should choose of your own volition to actually and completely observe accordingly my prescriptions for living, that which I have inscribed in writing to cut you into the relationship, and my means to resolve disputes, my misfot, the ability to exercise good judgment regarding your vindication. Whoever over time and as an ongoing process acts upon and engages with them, that person indeed is actually and completely restored to life, and as a result of this desire, this decision, will live forever through them. I am Yahweh. So God is talking about the aspects, very important aspects of his Torah. The chuk, which are inscriptions that are engraved in writing that cut us into the covenant relationship. And he's speaking of the mishpat, which are represent the means that Yahweh uses to resolve our rebellion, our disputes, our sin, so that we can be vindicated and can exercise good judgment and be viewed before God as innocent, while God still remains just because he has created the provision for this to occur. And so God is telling us that he has articulated these. They're the basis of his Torah, his Torah guidance, and that it is by engaging and acting upon these things, this means that Yahweh has conveyed to resolve disputes, which are the four Moed Mikre, where we are invited to meet with God and be called out of this world. And that those teachings, those instructions that he has chiseled in stone, that he has inscribed in writing, that guide our response so that we engage properly to him. And yet Paul would have us believe that this same testimony cannot save, when Yahweh is saying that is the very basis of you being restored and the very basis of continuing to live. So God's presentation in context is the very antithesis of Paul's citation. So one of the two cannot be trusted. So in this passage in Korah called out Leviticus 18:5 that Paul is truncating and misquoting, Yahweh is telling everyone who's interested in listening to him that if you want to survive your mortal life, if you want to live with him, if you want to be restored to life, you need to pay attention to what he has to say in his Torah and act upon his offer. And let us not forget everything God had to say up to this point, everything he had to offer, everything that could be examined and acted upon, the totality of his communication with those who wish to engage and endure with him, Yisraelites, is contained in this very book that he was reciting to his children, the Torah. It was the sole basis of restoration and life. Therefore, Paul has once again deliberately abbreviated and misappropriated a passage which is wholly inconsistent with his own message, perhaps in hoping that the use of some common words would be sufficient to convince his unthinking audience that God supports his position. This is now the third time in three statements that Paul has quoted twice from the Torah, one from Chabaouk, the very God who he claims was inspiring him, and yet he misquoted him, took his statement out of context, and then misled those reading this letter into believing that the very God who said the opposite was actually endorsing Paul's contrarian position. That is a con man. A person who would do that should should never be trusted, never, under any circumstance. In the quoted verse, God absolutely and unequivocally did not say that the law is very different than faith. Didn't say that at all. Not anything even remotely close to that. He did not say that through faith a person has life. Not anything even remotely close to that. He didn't say that through obeying the law a person has life. There isn't even a Hebrew word for obey. To shamar is to observe, to examine and consider, not keep. And a shah, to act and to engage, is to respond to what we have learned if we shamar are observant. A concept light years removed from obey. Moreover, neither chukah, prescriptions which are inscribed in writing that cut us into a relationship, nor misfot, the means to resolve disputes, exercising good judgment, are laws. These things represent the way Yahweh's Torah, Chaya, restores and renews our lives, or at least those who consider them and act upon them. Yahweh, speaking in first person, said that a close examination and careful consideration of his prescriptions for living that he has inscribed in writing that cuts us into the covenant relationship and the means that he has offered to exercise good judgment regarding his means to resolve disputes enables those to live who respond to what he is offering. This is, of course, the antithesis of the Pauline and Christian position. Now, while we are making distinctions, it is important to realize that it is grotesquely inappropriate to refer to Yahweh's Torah as law, as Paul does throughout his letters. The Hebrew word Torah means source from which teaching, instruction, direction, and guidance flow. It is based on the Hebrew word Yara. His presentation is educational. His witness is enlightening. He is offering guidance, which we are free to embrace or reject. He is not controlling. Moreover, his way is not restrictive, as laws are, but instead liberating. It's not my opinion. This is exactly what Yahweh himself says. And if you don't care what God says, if you're willing to disregard God's perspective on these very issues, which are identical to what I have just shared, if you're going to discard that in favor of Paul, then you have made a choice for which there is no remedy. If you say, I'm going to disregard God's perspective, I'm going to disregard God's testimony, I am instead going to believe a man who claimed to be inspired by that same God, who contradicted him and said exactly the opposite, there is no hope for you. You've lost the ability to exercise good judgment. It is grotesquely inappropriate to refer to Yahweh's Torah as law. The Hebrew word Torah, as I've shared with you, means source from which teaching, instruction, direction, and guidance flow. It is not shared with us to limit us, but to liberate us. It is the sole source of guidance regarding how we can participate in a relationship with Yahweh. It is the lone means that God has provided to save his children. If you reject the Torah, you are rejecting God. If you reject the Torah, you cannot engage in a relationship with God. If you reject the Torah, you cannot be saved. Rabbis, like Paul, who was trained to be a Pharisee, deliberately perverted Yahweh's testimony to validate their own set of laws, a set of religious arguments recorded principally in the Talmud. So by referring to the Torah as nomos, it should that term be used to infer law, Paul, who was educated in Hebrew, demonstrated that he cannot be trusted. Now, it's interesting, nomos doesn't actually mean law. It has been perverted to that by religious copy editors. It's something that's very common for them to do. They will very often replace something that is found in an old document that claims inspiration with a term of their choosing. A great example would be in the eyewitness accounts when Yosha is having the conversation. He's having the conversation in Hebrew, but it's translated into Greek with his disciples, and he is talking about his mikre, his invitations to meet, which are the basis of our salvation. And he's talking about his mikre, the closest Greek word for mikre, which is an invitation to be called out and meet, is the Greek word ecclesia. Well, ecclesia is not nearly as rich as mikre. The fact of the matter is that Christian copy editors changed ecclesia, which was a translation of mikre, invitations to be called out and meet with God, to church. So, Kirk, I want to thank you for calling in. If you were to read the eyewitness accounts that are part of the so-called Christian New Testament in Greek, would you ever find the word church? Well, we have Kirk on the line. We have him dialed in, but we can't seem to hear from him. So if we get that resolved, we'll go back to Kirk. But the answer is no. It is very common for religious publications to deliberately change what God said. Nomos being referred to as law is a great example. When nomos makes its appearance very early in the process, nomos was used some 300 times in the Septuagint. Every time that Yahweh used Torah, we find that in the Greek translation of the Hebrew text, nomos was used. And so nomos means Torah according to those who translated the Torah from Hebrew into Greek. So there is no justification for translating it law, because Torah and law aren't the same thing. Hello, Kirk. I hope we have you back again, do we?
Yes, sir. I got cut off somehow. I don't know what happened, but I don't want to get you off topic too much, but yeah. I was going to ask you one quick question in regards to Paul. I can't find any prophet, anyone called of Yahweh, where he would beat him up or torture him or coerce him to go out and do what he says. Now, the only two that we come to mind where that happens, of course, is Muhammad and Paul.
Correct.
I mean, is that a valid question?
Yeah,
I mean,
it's interesting. There's many aspects of Paul which are wholly inconsistent with all who Yahweh inspired to speak for him. One example is only Paul speaks in first person. Yahweh speaks in first person through his chosen prophets, but Paul says, "But I say." That's one example. The other example is that most of those that, in fact, I think virtually everyone that God has chosen to communicate for him were reluctant to do so, and they had a low regard for their own personal self-worth or ability. And Paul jumps up on his soapbox and says, you know, me, myself, and I am the greatest. Nobody is better than or more important than I am. He's the opposite. But the other thing that is the specific point that you're bringing up, Kirk, is that Yahweh himself presents his teaching as a take-it-or-leave-it proposition. He never compels. So even when God is speaking, whether it's directly or through one of his prophets, he will say, this is what I'm offering you. You're welcome to come to know it, understand it, and act upon it. It's my offer to you. I would love for you to choose to benefit from it, but it's your choice. It's always presented under the auspice of free will. And yet Paul said, if you don't acquiesce to what I'm saying, if you don't agree with my interpretation, then you are going to be attacked. And he viciously attacked the disciple Shimon Kephas, known as Peter. He viciously attacked Yohanan, known as John. He viciously attacked Jacob. And he viciously attacked the Yehudim, the Jews, who were following the Torah and the Messiah Yahusha, that were in his audience because they didn't capitulate. I mean, so, you know, if your point is, is there any other example where somebody who is authorized to speak for Yahweh says, you either agree with my unique interpretation, or I'm going to bludgeon you and send I'm going to demean you so that you're hunted down and killed. I don't think you'd find one.
Yeah, it's the same with what I was thinking also, you know, when he's goes blind,
mm-hmm.
allegedly, and he's, you know, that just is so not in keeping with Yahweh.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine Yahweh saying,
blind you
it's the same thing with Muhammad, where yeah. his encounter, first of all, if Paul met with Yahusha on the road to Damascus, then Yahusha himself is a liar and should not be trusted. So we shouldn't even count that as a benefit, because Yahusha said, if somebody claims to have seen me in the wilderness, don't believe him. When I return, everyone's going to see me at the same time. Do not believe the person. Do not follow the person who claims to have seen me. So if when Paul claimed to have seen him, that made Paul a liar, or it made Yahusha a liar. And if Paul wasn't a liar, to represent someone who is a liar would be a waste of time. You should not trust him. But you're right. What his experience is was debilitating. And he claimed to be worn out, to be, you know, to wrestle with this spirit and to be blinded by and have to be nursed back to health. It's exactly the way that Muhammad described his encounter with the aggressive spirit in the cave. I've spent a lot of time with him. I spend time with him every day when I study his teaching. I have never, ever encountered any situation with Yahweh where he was anything other than kind, uplifting, accommodating, supportive. You know, he's rather than the kind of spirit that would wrestle you to the ground and would smack you around and would blind you, he's opening my eyes. He's extraordinarily humble and gentle. He's not wishy-washy, but he's gentle in a very kind way. It's his depiction of the God that he met is the opposite of the God that I've come to know.
You know, when you first started writing the book, mm-hmm. Question and Paul, and it didn't take very long before you read just a little bit of it, or in our case, we heard you discussing it back when Yoel, back in the old days,
mm-hmm.
and as you were going through it and fighting through all that stuff, and it was just so, it takes so little to go through Paul and realize that he's not an apostle, he's not a
right.
disciple.
Right.
He certainly doesn't speak for God, but you can't seem to get through people.
Right.
Anyone we talk to is just it's so overwhelming
yeah.
to them
yeah.
to attack him. It's like you've attacked God instead of Paul. I mean, it's,
yeah. And if you just began at the beginning, and you listen to what Yahusha said in the Olivet Discourse, where he's having his kind of final discussion before his fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim, and he's talking to his disciples about what they can expect, and they're full of questions. And he says, you know, tells them that somebody is going to, tells them, that somebody is going to come along in their lives that's going to claim to have seen him. Only one person did. And he says that when that person comes along that's going to claim him to see him in the wilderness, on the road to Damascus, for example, don't believe him, that it's not true. I mean, once you just put those two things together, and, you know, I know that, Kirk, you listen to this program when that happens to be Larry's full stop. I mean, you really don't have to go any further than that.
Right.
Once you put those two statements together, it is impossible for Paul to be telling the truth. Right. But you go the next step, which you've just done, is this next step. Every Christian knows that Paul needed days to recover, that he was struck blind, and that he was beaten, abused to the point physically where he required days to recover. I tell you what, I have been beaten up by people emotionally, physically, in a number of different ways. I have spent a lot of time with Yahweh. I've spent a lot of time in His Word. I have never, ever experienced Yahweh as anything but uplifting and kind. The God that Spirit, that he met on that road, is the antithesis of the God of the Torah. We're doing a little comparison here with Kirk. Kirk, I have a question for you. Did Yosha give the blind sight, or made the those with sight blind?
I think he gave them sight.
Okay, so when Paul went from being able to see to being blinded, was it likely that it was the same individual that he encountered?
I would not think so.
Okay.
I think it'd be the opposite.
When Yosha was about giving his meeting with people in large numbers, did he prepare and make food for them so they would be nurtured, or did he take food from them so that they would need time to recover from being emaciated?
No, sir. He fed the masses.
Okay. Is there any example of Yosha taking person that he encountered and wrestling with him and beating him up so that person would have to recover from their wounds, or did he heal those that he encountered?
He healed.
So what is the likelihood that the person that we learn about and from the eyewitness accounts was the same individual that Paul met on the road to Damascus?
It would be impossible in my thinking.
Let me ask you one other question. We have Paul saying that the spirit that he met on the road to Damascus says, it is difficult for you to kick against, to rebel against the goad. Is that a line that is attributed to Yahusha?
No, I know that's Dionysius' favorite line, or one of his more popular lines.
Yeah, I think it's actually his favorite line. Do you have any idea? It's a fairly ascertained and fairly a difficult question, and the fact it just deals with a very unique aspect of Dionysus's mythical persona. But you know why Dionysus says it's difficult for you to kick against the goat?
I'm not sure.
No. Yeah, it's not something that anyone would normally know. I don't know why I'm a reservoir for such useless information, but the idea was that the societal gods, Dionysus, of course, Dionysus only exists in the minds of religious clerics. And the religious clerics don't want anyone rebelling against them. They don't want anyone exposing them, just like today in Christianity or in Islam. They don't want to be exposed. So there's an enormous consequence of going against the mass of society and trying to oppose a religious figure. And so the Dionysus himself does not exist, but the religious clerics that created the Dionysus myth did. A goad is a sharp prod that you use to herd dumb animals. And so the line from Dionysus, from the clerics who created the myth of Dionysus, was designed specifically to tell the population, this is a really difficult thing. You should think twice before you attempt to rebel against us, or to criticize us, or to go against us, because we have this goad that's hurting all of the other dumb animals in our religion, and you don't want to step out of line. Otherwise, we're going to poke you.
Yeah, you think this is what they think of you, huh?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's so revealing as to who Paul was when he cited Dionysus. And not just an average quote. Dionysus is the most famous line. And he attributed it to his Yosha. And it was a line that would epitomize Pauline doctrine. You either go along with it or, like all the other dumb religious animals, or you're going to get poked. You know, when Paul admitted in 2 Corinthians that he was demon-possessed, did he speak of a sharp poke, a goad in the side when he was attributing?
Yeah, that's the one they argue about all the time. You know, it's what was this terrible thing issue? I mean, this terrible thing poking him in the side.
Yeah, and that yeah, actually, it's the same exact thing. It's a goad. And so he tells you what the goad is in his side. He says it's a messenger of Satan, a demon that is possessing him and goading him to act the way he does. Now, you'd think that if you knew that he quoted Dionysus, if he knew that the encounter he had with the spirit on the way was the antithesis of Yosha, if you knew that Yosha had said, if somebody claims to have seen me, until the whole world sees me at the same time, they're lying. You'd think that somewhere along the way, people would say, you know, I think I need to reject that individual. They began their mission based upon a lie.
Right. It just keeps coming back time and time again. I understand why a preacher does this, but I cannot understand why somebody can't see that. That's not complicated at all.
No, none of it is. We don't have to get into the fact that Paul took what Yahweh said out of context to reveal the opposite of God's message to convict Paul. His initial claim of having been called, his conversion experience, is sufficient in itself. Thank you, Kirk. We'll be back with you tomorrow. May God bless.